It's time for Operation Freedom with your host, Dr. Dave Janda, on Southeast Michigan's conservative powerhouse, Wham Talk 1600.
Welcome back to Operation Freedom, folks. I'm Dr. Dave Janda, broadcasting live from Wham Talk 1600's Freedom Bunker. We're here every Sunday from 3 to 5 Eastern. This show would not exist without our sponsors. I encourage you to go to their websites. I encourage you to utilize their services to help you with your freedoms. And when you go to their sites or when you call them up for an order, thank them. Thank them for supporting your freedom, because without their help and support, this show, my voice, would be silent. First of all, the Camino Company for your precious metals needs, 1-800-348-8001. As we've mentioned, and we will get into in the next last half hour of our show today, we are headed for a financial hurricane, and we're just about to get hit by the back wall of the hurricane. And single most effective way to protect yourself is with precious metals, that being gold and silver. I've dealt with this company for 20 years, CaminoCompany.com, 800-348-8001. They are the best in the business. You can go to their website, Camino, C-A-M-I-N-O, company.com. For your cybersecurity needs, if this mess with the NSA doesn't tell you need to do something, boy, I don't know what'll tell you more. CryptoHippie. CryptoHippie.com, single most effective way to protect your hardware, your computers. We've done it with our computers, and since then, we have not had any attacks. For your legal needs, Brooks Cushman, Cushman with a K, K-U-S-H-M-A-N. They're based in Los Angeles, California, and Southfield, Michigan, for your legal needs. They're a intellectual property firm, trademarks, copyrights, patents, but for any of your legal needs, they will steer you in the right direction. And for your car needs, Quick Lane of Canton, whether it's an engine rebuild, new tires, oil change, they're the best in the business, most effective in the business. Quick Lane of Canton on Canton Center Road, north of Ford Road. I am very, very pleased to have back with us a huge fan favorite and one of our really big-time medical consultants, Dr. Jane Hughes. She is a board-certified ophthalmologist and ophthalmologic surgeon and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons. She graduated from the great University of Iowa with a BA degree and then received her medical degree from the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. In addition to her private practice, she is a clinical professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of Texas Health Science Center, and she is also the founder of one of the founders of a great organization, AmericanDoctorsNumber4Truth.org. I encourage you to go to their site. Jane, welcome back to Operation Freedom.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's just a real pleasure to be with you on this Sunday afternoon in the bunker, fighting away for personal liberty and freedom.
So, Jane, in the state of Michigan, we have a governor that's created a one man's Groundhog Day movie scenario. We keep in this having to vote in the House and Senate in Michigan on essentially Obamacare, right? He keeps bringing back, it keeps getting defeated, and then he keeps bringing it back. And his latest issue he's bringing back is Medicaid expansion. It failed in the House and Senate the first time through. Then he ended up bringing it back and got it kind of slithered through the House. But then the Senate said, we've already voted for this, we're not voting on this, and put it off. And then he threw a hissy fit. Now he's created a handpicked committee that he and Randy Richardville, who's the head of the Senate, they're going to kind of oversee this committee, it appears, and they appointed the people that were on it. And then they're going to try to reintroduce it back into the Senate for a vote. And when I talk to folks around the country, there are other governors that are doing the same, have the same MO. Jane, one of the defenses that folks in the legislatures around the country are making is they say, well, healthcare exchanges and Medicaid expansion are not a part of Obamacare, so we're really not really, when we pass Medicaid expansion, try to pass Medicaid expansion or healthcare exchanges, we're really not passing Obamacare. That's delusional.
Well, that's absolutely delusional. Those are the two parts of the puzzle that are designed to get every single man, woman, and child in America on some form of government-approved insurance. And from that point, we, as they have stated, the crafters of the law have stated, it will be a much easier movement to move to that single-payer system, that pie in the sky that the progressives have been talking about since they started talking about health care reform.
And the other part is that if health care exchanges are not a part of Obamacare, then why is Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius soliciting big companies for donations to fund health care exchanges so Obamacare can move ahead?
Well, the keystone, as you and I both know, because we do understand the law, we have read it, we've been saying all along that it cannot work. We do know that the cornerstone are the state-run healthcare exchanges. Without the state-run exchanges, individuals are not going to be able to get the tax credits and subsidies to pay for these now astronomically expensive, quote, government-approved, unquote, insurance policies.
And there are legislators in the state of Michigan and actually around the country that are also saying Medicaid expansion is not a part of Obamacare. And my point to them is then, so why did the Supreme Court rule as it relates to Medicaid expansion when they were ruling out Obamacare?
Now, I cannot understand how anyone with any amount of credibility could possibly state that Medicaid expansion and exchanges are not part of Obamacare. Actually, that's one part of Obamacare, those two components that are the ones that deal the most directly with health care insurance. There are many things in Obamacare that have really nothing to do with health care or making people who have illness able to access care more easily. If anything really does have to do with health care insurance, it's those two components of the bill.
So, Jane, when the governor got stuffed by the Senate and said, we've already voted on this, we didn't pass it, we're not going to vote again. Okay, he came back. He had this incredible hissy fit press conference, and here's screeching. And here's what the governor said: "Quote, but how are you going to feel if we do nothing? And you walk in there and you see chair after chair of working poor people, hardworking people sitting in those chairs, knowing that that's their healthcare system when we could have given them a better answer." End quote.
Well, you and I both, again, have
better
talked
answer.
About this previously, that Medicaid is the worst possible insurance that you can have if you become ill. Mm-hmm. It's also the worst possible insurance you can have for, quote, preventative medicine. And there are studies that we don't need to go into here, but they're totally available with a Google click. So Medicaid is not a good solution for these people, and the states themselves, the governors themselves, have recognized how it's exorbitantly expensive, it's very poor care, and they've been looking at ways to try to revise Medicaid and actually get rid of it and replace it with, like, state grants so that they could actually do innovative things to take care of people like that.
And a good example of that would be in Indiana with the Indiana Healthy Project or program.
Yes, yeah. It was very successful.
So, what I've done, Jane, is I've actually written an op-ed that I've submitted not only locally, not only through the state, but actually nationally called Do No Harm. And I've invited Governor Rick Schneider to this show next Sunday. I've emailed his office. I've contacted his office. No response back. But I really want to put this out in the public domain and really present the facts to him, because what he's talking about, he either, who's ever advising him, is not giving him the information, or if they are, he's lying and he's trying to harm every person in our state. So I am giving him the opportunity to come on this show in a week and have at it.
I think that's an excellent idea, because part of what is missing in this entire healthcare debate are exchanges, just like you're promoting right here, with a politician, a public official, with a physician who actually has been in the trenches and knows how medicine works and what it's going to take to actually fix it, which you and I both know is not Obamacare.
You know, Jane, in the past, your other interviews, we've talked about how Obamacare is being slowly whittled away. The first was when the small business health exchanges were delayed until January 2015. And then Obama removed the pre-existing condition component of Obamacare in March of this year. This week, the employer mandate was delayed until, at the very earliest, January 1st, 2015. So, what's the significance of that?
Well, the significance is that we are beginning to see this train come off the rails. Mm-hmm. And it started with the closing of the Class Act section early on. If you recall, that was the Ponzi scheme where senior citizens were supposed to get long-term care, but they weren't going to issue any of the benefits for several years while collecting all of the premiums. Mm-hmm. And then, as you mentioned, the small business exchanges, that was supposed to be, they euphemistically called it the shop. Mm-hmm. But there was only one product they could offer. We could go on and on. How about the hospital project for Obamacare's accountable care organizations, which are better known as health maintenance organizations, only they're a particularly sinister kind where there's rationing of care. A third of the hospitals who agreed to participate announced 2 weeks ago that they're going to drop out, saying that they're very skeptical that they'll be able to work. So, yes, we're seeing it run off the rails, and it's because of the way it was written. It's because of the way it was passed. And you and I both know that Obamacare has very little to do about taking care of Americans and their health care needs, and everything to do with taking over one-sixth of the private sector economy.
Well, that's exactly it. It's all about control. It's nothing about providing more available, more affordable, or more quality-oriented care.
That's the tragic part, because every day that we have these fits and starts of implementation of Obamacare has a human cost, it has an economic cost in terms of our job recovery and employers being able to expand their companies, but the human cost is we are delaying the real reform that needs to happen, because in my opinion, in America, we do not have a medical quality problem. Mm-hmm. We have a medical care cost problem, and it's fixable, but we are not fixing it.
Well, let's talk about fixing it. You have an 11-point plan that you've distributed far and wide. It's outstanding. It's comprehensive. It includes number of the things I've spoken about for a while now. And so educate our listeners on what you think needs to happen here to make healthcare more available, more affordable, and more quality-oriented. Because I believe your 11 points really address these issues.
Well, first and foremost, we have a totally opaque system. Unlike any other huge economic sector, people go into a hospital, they have no idea what it's going to cost. They get their bill. It's almost unintelligible. People go to a doctor's office, and they have no idea of what it's going to cost, what the fees are. And what we need to do, there are three things off the bat. One, we need to separate the employer and the employee in terms of purchase of health care insurance. And that would be a straightforward transfer of the tax benefits so that the employer could give the employee a designated amount of money, a defined contribution, and the employee would then purchase their own health care insurance, the kind that they need and they want, which might be a health savings account and then a major medical so that they pay for their own routine care, and when they are truly catastrophically ill, they're not going to go bankrupt if they need a kidney. And that's the second component. We have to return to an indemnity-type health care insurance. Just think if hurricane insurance included painting your house, putting a new roof on, etc., we would have what we see in Great Britain. The big model for our Obamacare was their health care system. They provide all sorts of preventative, quote-unquote, care and routine care. But if you are elderly, if you are frail, if you're truly ill, your care is rationed. That is not our ethic in the United States of America. We hold individuals each to have dignity and worth. And the socialized healthcare system where all your little routines are covered, but when you're sick, look out, is certainly not a model to be emulated. And finally, when we go back to a major medical and health savings account, physicians need to stop making third-party contracts. And I mean with preferred providers, with Medicare, with Medicaid, and go back to their contract being the best possible care for their individual patient based on their patient's needs and what's best for that individual patient. The patient's responsibility is to pay the physician for services rendered, and it becomes the physician's option to render charitable care and their obligation to have a transparent fee schedule that there is no cost shifting one patient to the other. Everyone pays the same, and let people pay out who can't or just do charitable care like many of us have already done, and we've mentioned that before on your program. But those three things alone would launch us forward to be able to sustain and afford the wonderful technological advances we've had in medicine and our compassionate care, not to mention pain management and all the early diagnostics that Americans have come to expect.
The key that you outlined so eloquently are health savings accounts. And actually, I first got involved with these back in 1988 with Malcolm Forbes Sr., actually. He was actually starting to implement them for his companies. And I contacted him back in 1988 and had some discussions with him about health savings accounts. And it's interesting, he said to me, Jane, he goes, you know, you're the first doctor ever to call me or write me or contact me about health savings accounts. He goes, you know, doctors,
wow.
He goes, doctors are afraid of those things. And he goes, I think it's actually the future of healthcare delivery in our country, or should be. And I agree with him. But I can tell you, Jane, I'm 25 years, I've been pushing health savings accounts. And essentially, as you outlined, they make people better consumers of healthcare. Right, because they control the finances. The HMO doesn't. The insurance company doesn't. The government bureaucrats don't. Which is why I think there's a lot of pushback against them. Right.
Well, yes, and interestingly, in Obamacare, health savings accounts are capped at, I believe it was $2,500 a year.
Right.
Where people could put money into the health savings account. But if you look at a recent study that showed that the average healthy younger person, like 45 and under, their average individual health care costs, if they were to pay out of pocket, were something like $850 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you can roll over whatever savings you have into the next year, after a while you've got a substantial amount of money in a health savings account. And second of all, a really important point, Florida, and I believe Indiana as well, set up pilot projects where they had Medicaid recipients mm-hmm. have health savings accounts. So
mm-hmm.
literally, they wrote the check for their own health care, and they found that even though the state and the federal government were contributing the money into that account, they suddenly became good stewards of their health care dollars.
Yeah, I have. It's interesting because before Indiana implemented that, and it was back in, I believe, 2007, they started implementation. It was under Mitch Daniels was the governor at the time there.
Yeah.
Their folks had been in touch with me because I had been writing about this and talking about this for a while. And they said, well, you know, we've kind of worked the numbers out, and we think people are going to have the same insurance anyone in the state can get as opposed to an inferior product like Medicaid by giving them a health savings account, those in Medicaid. And we think they're going to be healthier, and we're going to save a ton of money. And I said, right. And they said to me, well, why are we like one of the first states to do this?
Well, one of the major components of reform, and by the way, I can't answer that question. I think it takes a very innovative governor, a very hands-on governor. Mitch Daniels was my hero when I read how he went about implementing this mm-hmm. and how he got all the players mm-hmm. on board.
Mm-hmm.
But it slides into another point. I do think that it's going to be governors and state by state by state where innovative approaches are going to occur. And as a matter of fact, in your own state, there's a meeting coming up of physicians all across the country who are converging, and we're talking about a private care network whereby our compact is with our patients and not with any third-party payers, and it should be quite an interesting, innovative conference.
And that conference is July?
I think it's July 22nd or July 23rd, but there will be, I'm sure, press releases about it, but the concept is where there would be a web portal easily accessible where those physicians who choose to can post their fees and have one fee schedule for all of their patients, not any of these third-party contracts where you get 20% off if you're in the Aetna PPO, but a straightforward, reasonably priced fee schedule with a easily accessible web portal where people all across the country could click on in their own town and see who was a private network physician, meaning that their contract was going to be with their doctor.
One of the things that I found through the Indiana experience was one of the big entities trying to block the utilization of health savings accounts in the Medicaid population was actually the insurance industry. And the reason is because the insurance industry sees HSAs as a death knell for them. The administrative costs that insurance companies pass on with health savings accounts to employers, to individuals, is about 1% of the policy, while the administration costs they pass on for their standard programs is over 30%.
Well, I believe that.
Yeah, so the insurance industry, and insurance industry has, as we all know, a lot of money, and they throw a lot of money into lobbying. What we actually found was that the biggest block to the utilization of health savings accounts for Medicaid populations, or even making them more tax-advantaged for everybody in a state, was actually the insurance industry. And second was actually the medical groups, because what health savings accounts do, as you well know, Jane, is they make docs, providers more accountable, not only from a price standpoint, but from an interaction standpoint with their patients. Right?
Absolutely, and that is what is needed. No one is saying, or I shouldn't say no one, let me say this. I am not saying, as a physician, that physicians are not playing a part in the problems that we face in the cost of health care. We have to be more responsible as physicians, more transparent, and you are absolutely right. If somebody is paying themselves and you have a transparent fee schedule, then I can tell you just from going in the Medicare program from a participating provider to someone who still sees Medicare, but the Medicare patient pays me and they get reimbursed, it has fostered the important questions. When I want to order a test, the patient will say to me, "Doctor, how much is it going to cost and what are we going to gain from it?" I welcome that and I feel that that is an integral part the doctor-patient relationship, and then we make an intelligent, good decision together.
It really reestablishes the doctor-patient relationship as a team.
Exactly.
Without an insurance executive being there or a government bureaucrat being there. You know, Jane, you feel that way, I feel that way, but I can tell you I've had a number of folks within our own profession put their finger in my chest, tell me I'm a bad guy because of me pushing for free market reform such as health savings accounts. There are physicians that have told me that they don't have the time to be talking to patients. They don't have the inclination to be talking to patients about fees or some of them actually try to minimize the time they're with a patient as opposed to maximizing their time, not just lengthwise, but quality wise, right? We do have an internal problem within medicine itself, I'm hoping it's the vast minority of folks within the profession, but there is a fairly vocal component of the medical profession that's been very angry with me over the past 25 years for pushing the concept of health savings accounts.
Well, I have one answer for that, too, and that is that those physicians who feel that way, who don't want to spend the time with their patients to explain what their problem is or to discuss the economic impact of a test order, in a free market system where the individual owns their own insurance that they've picked, they're not railroaded into a certain group of doctors because they're in an employer-purchased PPO. Mm-hmm. If you let the free market work, then those physicians are going to have pretty empty waiting rooms compared to those physicians who are wanting to go back to a patient-centered, physician-guided, free market-driven reform. And let's make one other comment about the free market. You and I both know that the free market will only thrive and work with an ethical and moral construct.
Absolutely.
And it's reliant on that. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things we've seen become degraded when we watch the government take over medicine. Because let's face it, look at the IRS debacle. These are the people that are going to be administering the major component of Obamacare. They're going to have intimate knowledge not only of your health issues, but your bank routing number. Is this what we mean by patient-centered, physician-guided reform? No, this is moving in the wrong direction.
Well, in fact, the IRS was just sued by an organization in California for violation of taking 10 million patients' medical records, including 60 million documents associated with those 10 million patients, without authorization.
It's shocking to me, the revelation, although we had suspected it, but the revelation at how broad the implication is for the IRS agency. They have breached a major trust with the public, and the arrogance of the individuals who've been brought before Congress to testify is, to me, breathtaking. And if the both Democrats and Republicans in Washington, D.C. don't see that the IRS must be stripped out of Obamacare for it to proceed, I think we're in for a very, very rocky road.
Well, you know, Jane, many of the Republicans and conservatives in Washington have been completely silent on that issue about the IRS's role in Obamacare, and especially with these revelations of how they've targeted not only groups, but personally speaking, individuals for their views. They've been mute on the issue. This should be another calling card of why Obamacare needs to be stopped immediately.
I agree. A moratorium right now on further implementation is totally called for. I'm hoping that the Republicans and Democrats wake up.
Jane, how can folks follow you?
Well, they can go to our adsforpeace.org website, or I'm on Twitter at JaneHughesMD. I'd love to have people follow me. I try to post pertinent things, but Ads for Truth is kept up to date.
Jane, I'd like to thank you for everything that you do to enhance every American's healthcare freedom. Folks, you're listening to Operation Freedom. I'm Dr. Dave Janda, broadcasting live from WAMTALK 1600's Freedom Bunker. We're here every Sunday from 3 to 5 Eastern.